Hello, fellow Egypts. Welcome to Taranoia. Taranoia is, of course, my own special brand, my very special own Yellow Pack brand of insecurities and fears, which I reckon we all have because we're all Egypts, but we're all only doing our best. Now, I want to stress, with the stuff that we're going to talk about in this episode, I'm no expert. In fact, I'm going to tell you quite how much of a non-expert that I am fairly early on. Because my incredible guest, I have a guest in studio, my incredible guest who's, you know, doesn't like to be called incredible at all, but he is, is my husband, Carl. Hey, Carl Austin, how are you? Welcome to the Head Stuff studio.
Hey, Tara. I'm fine, bricking it slightly, but fine.
Why are you bricking it? It's me.
It's not about you. It's about all those people out there listening and judging.
You've done radio. You're on the radio. What's wrong with you?
I've done radio against my will.
Against your will. You always trip off across the road there looking very happy to me. You know, because usually he gets to review movies, and that's the thing. Carl is such a movie nerd. It's unreal. And that's how we got to meet, actually, because Carl had been working on Bollywood films, which he's from. Tell the people where you're from.
I'm from America. Sorry about that. Inglewood, California.
Inglewood, California. And how did someone from Inglewood, California end up in Muswell Hill, London, living above a pine shop with an Irish person from Cork?
I often ask myself that question. I ended up in London itself because I had been working on Bollywood films from the States for quite some time.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. But before the Bollywood films, you know where I'm going with this. How did you get into making the Bollywood films, Carl? Tell the people.
I assume you're talking about the straight-to-video films.
Yeah, I am.
Before you know the Bollywood films.
Tell the people. Come on, this is a previously unexplored part.
When I was still a writer in Los Angeles, I was making my living writing straight-to-video erotic thrillers.
Ooh. Mm.
Any of those films that you would have seen sitting in a Blockbuster video with titles like...
Go on.
Fatal Erotica.
Oh my God. No, I am dead.
Basic. Stop it.
Basic Jizz-stinct.
No. Those are pornos.
Yeah, sorry. I was trying to beef it up, so to speak.
That's going a bit too far.
I just think it's hilarious. It makes me laugh so much. It's something I'd love to write those kind of things. They're so... That's why I wrote some Irish erotica in your grand, and because I'm slightly obsessed with that low level, non sexy sexy. You know, her mischievous breasts were glancing her boudoir. I don't know what you tell me. You're the expert.
No, far from an expert. All I was ever told was that every 15 pages, someone needed to be naked, or getting naked.
For some
particular reason.
That's constant dressing and undressing. Like getting naked takes a minute. I mean, unless it's a onesie with Velcro or something. And then being naked, well, that's relatively easy, but yeah.
Well, the way those films worked was just that, you know, it was mostly, you know, they mostly starred like some Playboy playmate or another.
Yeah.
And some male actor who may have been either famous at one time or related to someone famous, i.e. Don Swayze.
Oh, cool.
Or Edward Albert Jr. Along that level.
Yeah.
All of them lovely people and wonderful
good
actors. But it's just that they were eclipsed by a more famous sibling or something.
So they were doing a gig and you were all doing a gig. Yeah. And then that led to Bollywood, which led you to London.
Which led to the director that I had worked with on many of those low-budget erotic thrillers. He relocated to London and began to make Bollywood films from there. Because at the time, Bollywood had started to immigrate from simply making films in India, and they were shooting in places like London and Paris and, even Dublin. So at that point, he gave me a call and asked me if I wouldn't mind coming to London for a few months and working on some films.
It wasn't London, though, was it? It was Austerlitz, which is London adjacent.
It's a stone's throw from the outskirts of London.
Big Ben is so much smaller than I thought it was. I pictured this a lot different. Hey,
I had a really lovely Tesco right across the train tracks, so it's all I really needed.
Well, you never needed to leave.
No.
But so we met then in London, and you know that story has been told in lots of different places, so we won't go into that here. But you look it up sometime, guys. It's been a fun story how we met. But we ended up moving back to Dublin. And then, as big a culture shock as you'd had moving to London, you had another culture shock again coming to Ireland. Tell me about your first impressions of art. You're from Inglewood, California. You grew up, I mean, Boys in the Hood is basically, if people know the John Singleton film, Boys in the Hood, it is basically, you know, where you grew up. That was the time and place you grew up. So tell me so Dublin. First, our backgrounds are so different.
First impression of Dublin. Wow, it's small. And wow, it's white.
Okay, so for anyone who doesn't know, because a lot of people who have followed me on Twitter or know my video Racist B&B, Carl's a black fella. Like I said in episode one, he's one of those black fellas, like you see on the news. No, it was a culture shock, wasn't it, for you? That there were sort of phrases like one of those black fellas that you'd see on the news.
On several occasions, yes, within earshot, which was also quite surprising. Usually people say it like quieter, but no, not here.
No, well, you see, when I was growing up, we still had in our classrooms a thing called, there were charity boxes, little cardboard charity boxes that you'd put your pennies in, a spare penny or something like that. If you'd change after lunchtime, you'd put the spare penny in. And they were called the Black Babies boxes because they had pictures of African, you know, kids in Africa, maybe from a starving nation. And so the whole, my first contact with people of color was black babies, impoverished people who lived in Africa, and you would give charity money to. So
none of that ever made it to Inglewood, just to be clear.
So there's already, although it's a charitable notion, there's already an othering. There's already it's a very far away thing. It's a very, that there's someone who is very culturally different. And we never talked about race at all because it was majority white people here. So,
well, I mean, that's not that surprising. And I get that because where I grew up, like I said, there really were no white people. I mean, in Inglewood, outside of police officers, I don't think I actually saw a white person. Definitely not a white person my own age. Until I was 14 or 15 years old.
And really, you know, lovely, friendly neighborhood police officers that would come in and help old ladies across the road or help you with your shopping or you know, give you could ask them for directions, I bet.
Oh, yeah. No, those guys were wonderful. I still remember the last time I was helped across the road by a police officer. It only required two or three settings at the doctor afterwards for my arm. But yeah, they're great. Lovely folks.
Listen, and sure, we're all idiots and we've all messed up in life. No one's saying anyone's an angel here or an expert. But tell me about the first time you realized that maybe your race sensitivity was set a little too high then for Irish. there was one misunderstanding early on. I'd love it if you could tell that story.
I was visiting my sister-in-law and her husband down in Leap.
In County Cork, yeah.
Yes. And because I had been in the house for a couple of days and was going stir crazy, I decided on my own to have a wander down to the nearby village.
Down to Leap itself, yeah.
Yes. And to have a drink in the pub. So I just wandered into this pub and sat in the corner booth and ordered a drink and started to, you know, scribble in my notebook as, you know, what I do when I'm on my own. There were three or four, I guess you say, old fellas.
Yeah.
You know, at the bar. I noticed I made a bit of a kerfuffle when I came in initially, and that pretty much the entire time since then, they've just been whispering and looking and whispering and looking. And finally, one of them was obviously the one who drew the short straw, was kind of pushed forward to come over to my table. And he approaches me and he asks in, you know, the most, you know, casual way possible. He's like, excuse me, who do you belong to? Now, as Tara has said, my racial sensitivity might have been a bit high at that point. And my first response to this was, well, according to Abraham Lincoln, I don't belong to no damn body. So what are you asking? At this point, the gentleman turned scarlet and reiterated and said, no, no, no. Who's your family?
Who do you belong to? I know it was an unfortunate choice of words for someone who's grown up in the U.S. As a person of color, but...
At which point I answered Flynn, and then suddenly there was just, you know, people buying everyone drinks and everything was fine.
Because the thing is, I think growing up without too many brown people around, of course that is changing now, and I that's something I love. I think diversity is absolutely brilliant, and... I love the way Ireland has changed. I mean, we need to address things like direct provision and what have you. There is, of course, systemic racism, and white supremacy is, well, white privilege is invisible and it's comfortable and people don't want to relinquish it. They don't realize they have it. I'll throw myself under the bus in a minute. But I think ultimately, Irish people just haven't questioned it. They haven't done that unpacking. They haven't examined systemic racism or overt racism. They haven't thought about it at all.
Well, it's hard to think or talk about racism when, as you say, up until recently, there was no one to be racist to.
Yeah. And so, but ultimately, I think the majority, especially when they get to know people in their communities, they're not overtly racist. They may have their internalized their racism. I know I probably did, or I was clueless about things. I mean, I should tell this story now that I've told you I'm going to tell. And it's a testament to how, that's why I say Carl's incredible, because I've learned a lot living with Carl, but it's not in the way many people would assume. That I don't get lectures from Carl, not at all. Carl lets me make my mistakes. And I always think when people say things like, oh, you're so woke, and it's a derogatory term to them, or they say, you know, you're so PC, like as if it's something I'm doing in a theoretical way. I'm not. It's not just that I'm doing something. I'm trying to watch my words, because they can not only hurt in a sort of the way of offense, but they can lead to an atmosphere where people actually do get hurt. They can normalize a kind of a violence or a violent attitude that can then become physical. I don't want to watch my words just in that way. But I want to, you know, if someone tells me that something is hurtful in any way, why would I continue to do it? But because I was married to someone, we weren't yet married. We'd be going out about a year and a half, 2 years. And Carl's got such amazing stories, and our backgrounds are so different. So I'm fascinated by his stories. He's fascinated by our Mad West Cork stories. We do swaps on mad shit that happened. It's very different mad shit. His had more guns in. But so I told a story on stage twice. It was a story about Carl's mum and Carl coming home late at night, and it ends up with a gunshot at Carl by his mum, and then she uses the N-word at him. And twice on stage, I feel I'm tearing up a little. I feel really uncomfortable sharing this with people, but there were people in the room and it happened. Twice on stage, I did reported speech. I said what she had said. And after the first time I went, oh, that gives me an uncomfortable feeling in my stomach. But I did it the next night. It was two nights in a row. I did it again. Partly because I had bought the bullshit about you've got to push the boundaries, you've got to be edgy in comedy, you've got to test language. I've road tested that shit, and it's shit. And after the second time I went to Carl and I said, I'm not doing that story anymore. I'm not comfortable. And tell the lads what you said.
Thanks for getting there.
Yeah. You waited for me to get there. Because it's not about preaching to people. It's about leading by example, I suppose, or telling people your stories and your lived experience. You've certainly helped me to understand that low-level hum. Tell me about the low-level hum of racism and microaggressions and just that constant shit.
Well, look, like the story you just told. It's like you can't tell someone. You can't make someone understand how a word like that makes you feel. You know, it's like I've had to have that conversation with people before where I'm not going to name anyone's name, but a friend of mine had, you know, gone on this cause about why can't white people use the N-word? why can't they?
And I think his theory was like what I've just said, in reported speech, et cetera, on stage, as part of a punctuation of a...
It was also partly...
It's necessary, in inverted commas.
It was also, if you can use it, why can't I use it?
Yeah.
And the response I had to give to him at the time, which, I mean, I think he eventually got there. I mean, he didn't quite get there on the day, but the response that I had for him was that when you say that word... It means something entirely different from what when we say it. Yeah. When you say it, it's a word that was used to humiliate. It was a word that was used, you know, to show power over someone. Whereas when we use it, it's not the same. It was like, and we use it with each other. It's almost for us. It's almost like taking the power back. From that word. Now, I myself try not to use it at all anymore. That's my personal choice, but I don't criticize other Black people for using it. But it's one of those words where it just means something entirely different depending on who says it.
You know, I'm not sure I'd ever said that word ever before. And then to do it on stage twice, and although it was the words out of your mom's mouth, and it was a funny story, and it was a family story, and you know, our backgrounds are so different, so all those criteria that all the lads try to say to me now is like, well, what about, why can't you, and why can't we, well, then is anything funny anymore? It's like, it's funny, but that's not funny. It wasn't funny. The rest of the story might have been. It wouldn't have suffered if I'd left it out.
No. And the question, like I said, the question is, and not this is meant for you, but it's meant for them.
I'll take it though.
Oh, I know.
I have to take it.
What I mean by that is that you already know. I'm talking about the people who are still trying to have that argument. What I say to them is, you know, don't. It's like, it's not whether you can use that word. It's why do you want to use it?
Mm.
Why are you using it? It's like if you can, if there's another word to be used that delivers that same laugh, then why use it? Other than the fact that you want to use it. And for me, that says a lot about somebody.
Well, it's also when someone goes to the trouble of explaining how deeply it pierces them and how shit it makes their life. Not, you know, because saying it on stage, a white person saying it on stage creates an atmosphere of normalizing.
Mm.
That word or that attitude to people of color, that diminishing, as you say, that humiliation. And you know, it's like, even if you're saying it because it's your friend or your mother-in-law, it's who has said it, my use of it is so completely different to your use of it. You know, I have a shit ton of white privilege. I have a shit ton of privilege in general. I have got class privilege. I've got, you know, white privilege. I've got cis privilege. I've got so much. And so I think one of the hardest reckonings for me was I didn't intend harm. I didn't mean to be racist, but I was doing racist things. I was saying racist things. I had a racist attitude. And that was so hard to accept and to learn. But it's and I'm not there yet. I'm still unpacking all of that. I've said unpacking twice now. I must be an American podcaster. No offense.
None taken.
What, can we not say American podcaster anymore? The hell? The hell? This is PC gone mad.
Me first, you first.
Well, we can both go. We have to do an ad.
Yeah.
Well, we're in somebody's podcast now. We are in a podcast.
Who's fucking podcast?
Somebody's podcast from the Head Stuff Network, because we're going to tell them about our podcast.
Oh, yeah, Dublin Podcast, yeah. So I'm PJ Gallagher.
And I'm Suzanne Kane.
And this is sort of an ad for the Dublin Podcast.
Stick us in your ears if you haven't done so already. What do we do on our podcast?
I don't know, but we've done it 111 times and there's loads more of it to come.
Dublin, the podcast.
Yeah, Suzanne's fucking sound. I'm a pain in the arse. It's a sort of a magical thing.
Factually correct.
I've noticed something that I was very teetering dangerously close to, particularly around the time of Racist B&B, where I wanted that to be an ally clip. So it's like, I didn't want to speak for anybody. That's why I really, really begged you, even though you're not comfortable on camera or on mic. So thank you for being here. Honestly, it really, you're so good. I'll make your favourite dinner. But I wanted it to be a standing with, not a speaking for. And that's why I showed you the script as we were going along. All of that, I wanted to get it right because I didn't want it to be I know about someone else's experience. I wanted to appeal to white people and say, when you say these words, even if you're being respectable, even if you're being nice, it hurts and it creates harm down the line, up to and including physical harm. So, but I did a radio show, a kind of an online radio show. You'll remember it. You were in the room. And the guy knew that I was clueless. He'd picked up that I was clueless. And
he was not a nice man.
He might not have been a nice man, but he was also right about some of it. And I had to reckon with it. But he was like, have you, you know, he was a person of color as well. He was a black guy. And he said, you know, have you ever been, he said, have you ever had racism meted against you? And it was, you know, that was a trap. It was a trick question. Because I went, well, I said, I have been to Asia. I've been to India. And, you know, you do stick out like a sore thumb there. And, you know, people assume certain things about you. Now, I've never used the words reverse racism, but he was tricking me. And it is really ignorant thing to say, yeah, because you're still the richest person in the area. Even if you're broke in Ireland or Britain terms, you're nowhere near as impoverished as the people living in India, in the majority of it. Of course, there's, you know, in Bollywood, you'll find some very rich people. But
of course, but they're the exceptions.
They're the exceptions. And then it was a trick question. But I was still very, very ignorant. I hadn't explored enough about my own attitude to all that. So when someone says, I've had reverse racism, or I've had racism because I'm Irish, you haven't had racism. You might have had anti-Irish discrimination. You haven't had someone make a presupposition about you because of the colour of your skin. What do you feel when people say, I had racism because I was Irish?
Well,
I know that's, it's a nuanced one, but
no, I get that.
Because there is historic oppression,
and there is oppression. There's similarities.
Yeah.
But as you say, it's. I mean, if you don't open your mouth, who's to know you're Irish?
Yeah.
It's like if I walk into a room.
I have a very spud head on me, so I think people would know.
I think you overestimate your head's.
I've said the S word.
Effect on people.
I don't know. Hey, he's saying I have no influence. I have no influence. Damn it! Even my husband thinks so.
When I walk into a room, it's, you know, there's no hiding, you know, anything. So it's what I've discovered in not necessarily in Dublin, but when I leave Dublin, is that, you know, there's a lot of attention and a lot of preconceptions.
Oh, you mean Ireland?
It's still in Ireland, but outside Dublin.
Yeah.
So,
well, it's outside Dublin. We do still get looks if we're together.
Yeah. A lot of looks.
Yeah,
I've just started to embrace it, and so I smile and I wave and I tell people I'm the president.
Yeah, you smile. Yeah, you. Well, although that is one of our, this is my favorite thing, Taranoia listeners. This is my favorite way to rib my husband, because he'll come back from town and he'll be like, either very happy.
It.
No, I have to tell it.
Stop
it's
it.
It's good. He'll come back and he'll either be on a high, or he'll be kind of, you know, so he'll be like, these kids, oh, they were so silly. They were so silly. But they kept going, oh, Mr. President. I mean, they thought I looked like Barack Obama, you know, a very handsome man. And, you know, certainly a different kind of president to the current one, whatever your opinions on either of them. And then he'll go, these little kids, I can't believe it. Such discrimination. They came up to me in the burger place and they went, hello, is it me you're looking for? And I go, Carl, it can't be that if it's Lionel Richie, they're racist. And if it's Barack Obama, they're right. It can't be. This cannot be.
It absolutely can be.
Oh, God.
It absolutely can be.
Okay. I'm blinded by my white privilege. I'm not to know.
I didn't want to say it, but yes.
What is your response to the people who say things like all lives matter, or things like you're not so oppressed, you're walking around without shackles on, are you oppressed? What do you say to those people?
Nothing that I can usually say on radio, to be fair.
It's radio, it's a podcast. Say whatever you want.
Well, depending on the day, sometimes it ranges from go fuck yourself.
Yeah.
To you absolutely have no understanding of what you're talking about, do you?
Yeah. They haven't thought about it at all.
No, not at all.
Something that came up in a talk I was doing during the summer, there was a, she was American actually, an African American woman, and she was saying, it's interesting to hear people talk, white people talk about understanding that low level hum of whatever it is, discrimination, could be really low level, like discrimination or just, oh, hey, can I touch your hair?
Oh, dear God, I hate that.
That low level stuff versus someone pushing or shoving or hitting you, mm-hmm. Which they do too. But
well, yeah, that's the thing. I mean, like, I know everything coming out of America right now, it's all like mad and crazy and scary and frightening. But it's, to be honest with you, it's like the white supremacists and the loud racists are not the ones I'm worried about, really, because, yeah. You know, we know who they are.
Yeah.
You know, they're there. They're right there. They can be dealt with. It's the, as you say, the low level, the ones that are kind of keeping it under wraps, and you know, it's like the not obvious racism is more what worries me in America at the moment.
But with everything that's happening in America at the moment, and the spikes in not just racism but in misogyny, in transphobia, that's a huge one at the moment. But those spikes, and I say spikes, that's what that woman said. She said there's the low levels, that's the low level is constant. You never know how someone's going to react. You brace yourself just in case. You're braced. And then the spikes, which are overt hatred or aggression or violence even. And I thought that was you know, it was really saddening to hear, but it's something I understood a bit better from having lived with you. Tell me about the hair touching, things like that, where people think they're being lovely and inclusive. What's that about?
I have no idea what that's about. Look, it hasn't happened to me in a while now. I think I've aged out of the bracket where people feel they can come up and do that. But it was a huge thing in my teens and my 20s, especially once I was bussed out to the quote unquote white schools. In my teens, just random people talking to you. They'll talk to you for 5 minutes and then think it's perfectly okay to just reach out and put their hand in your hair. Oh, it's so interesting. Can I touch it? It's like, well, you already have, firstly.
Do you find fists interesting?
Yeah. And, it's like, now I'm going to reach over and yank your head off your shoulders.
I have some interesting language for you. I think it's that as well, though, the low level hum of things like that are not meant to be aggressive. And it's when people don't intend harm, that's when they get defensive, because they're like, I didn't mean to hurt you. I didn't mean to harm you. But you're still saying, you're lesser. I'm going to just grab your head.
It's okay for me to do this.
Yeah.
Because you're different.
You're different. You're not the default setting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Which is white in white people's heads. Yeah. So, yeah, let's shake that out of us, kids. Let's shake it out of us. What about the people who just say, hey, I'm just teasing things out. I'm just asking questions. Talk about those guys.
Well, look. It depends on the number one. Depends on the question, and number two, depends on who's asking it and how. You know, I mean, like, I'm always open to having a conversation about race, but at a certain point, you know, you do have to just say, "I'm not going to talk to you about this anymore.
I can't reach this person.
You know,
they don't get it."
Yeah, it's like you can't. It's like no matter how many times you try to make someone understand your point of view, they're just not hearing it, because the next answer, whatever you say to them, the next question is, yeah, but this. And it's just like, okay, we're just going to keep going in this circle round and round and round and round. And you're not going to understand me. So let's just not talk about it.
There's a lot of chat about white feminism, white feminists leaving behind women of color, women, working class women. And I think that can be the case. And I think, you know, I blame stuff. I'm not going to name particular books or anything. But, you know, saying you too can be a CEO. And it's like, well, yeah, maybe. But maybe that structure is something to dismantle, as opposed to just blend in and be one of the guys.
Yeah, maybe it's not always good to be the one out of the hundred.
Yeah, I mean, unless you're bringing people up, you know, you're helping people to come with,
which is lovely. So many don't, though.
There is a real trick in white feminism, though. And again, it's something I've had to unlearn because it is horrible to be told you've made a mistake. It's horrible to be told you're wrong and to go, I didn't mean any harm, but I'm still wrong. It's hard. There's a tendency to get upset. And apparently
defensiveness,
but also in white women in particular, there's a tendency to get very upset and start to cry, require comfort from the person you've hurt. And so they now not only have to educate and explain, they've got to comfort you. And while you're going, I'm not a racist, I'm not, I never even hit you in the head. You know, while they're giving you a moment to sit and breathe and go, okay, I know I've done it. I know I've done it. I'm so ashamed. I wish I had a time machine to go back to those two nights on stage where I told your mom's story. I wish I had a time machine to go back to those times I've been defensive instead of just going, I know it's going to happen again. I've got too long in my life where this was unexamined in me that it's not going to happen again. And I'm trying so hard to park my defensiveness. And it fascinates me when I share these stories or I talk about my own... it's very hard to find words that people aren't going to use in a disparaging way, like awakening or learning, and just try to share those with people, and they go, "You're so self-righteous. You're judging other people. You're on your high horse." And I'm going, "I'm not."
Well, that's not about them. That's not about you. That's about them. So,
but I'm sharing my humiliation, my embarrassment, my rage at myself, my disappointment in myself. But instead of crying now and going, you called me a racist. They're not calling you a racist. People who say that, me or Carl or anyone else, they're saying what you said there could be construed as racist. Just have a think about it. It's not a condemnation. Well, I mean, I've been talking for a while now. Your perspective is much more.
Well, no, you're right. But you know, you're right. There's like I was saying with the friend I had spoken to previously about the N word. You know, it's like, there is that thing of, you know, you try to explain what is happening in a way without blaming them because they don't know. They don't know that they've offended you or that they've said something that could be construed as being racist or wrong or anything like that. But as you say, there's that level of defensiveness that rears its head when you do this. And it's like, and it makes it hard to have the conversation, you know, which... I mean, I don't know. Maybe that's kind of what people want. I don't know. Maybe it's like nobody seems to want to have the conversation about race.
It's really uncomfortable. That's
anymore.
Why. No, who wants to have it? It's so uncomfortable, but yeah, it has to be had.
And it does need to be. I mean, if we're ever going to, you know, as they keep saying, you know, we've all moved past it. It's like, we really haven't. We have not moved past anything yet.
I'm going to try harder now not to cry and to be less defensive.
I mean, if anything, America is showing us that at the moment. We have not moved past it.
Talk about America right now. That sounded like a command.
Yes,
hello,
ma'am.
Hello, guest. Hello, guest. Talk about America. Hey, American, talk about America.
Well, it's a clusterfuck. You know, to put it kindly, as we all know.
Say that on the fancy radio shows.
I could. I'd never be back. America is interesting at the moment. It's I can't remember who said this to me. It may have been you, or it might have been someone who said it to both of us. I can't remember, but it was the idea. Like I myself say at the moment, a lot of times I go, well, we're kind of heading towards that second civil war in America now. And someone said, well, it's not the second civil war. It's the first one never ended. This was just, you know, there was just a bit of a respite between.
Just went underground.
And it feels that way in America at the moment. It feels like there are lines being drawn along color lines, unfortunately. But it, I am worried about what's going on there, and I'm worried about where it's heading, but I'm trying to be positive about it. I'm seeing good things starting to happen. Certain people who have been silent for a while through this are starting to speak up now. I'm seeing more women of color standing up and being part of the political arena and refusing to be silenced and shoved aside. And I think, to be honest, this is my opinion. I said, when America finally does, if America gets fixed, it's going to be black women that fix it.
Yeah, no better women.
You know?
I mean, and this is the week, I mean, I don't know when this will go out, but this is the week that Serena Williams was chastised for being too much. You know, that stuff that many women hear, but black women in particular, too much, too angry, too aggressive.
I don't think she was angry enough. She should have yanked him out that chair. My mother would have.
Well, we don't advocate violence, except that since I've, you know, been living with Carl and, you know, everything, as the racism spikes and even here, these nationalist parties start to grow up, I've gone, listen, I'm getting a hurl. I'm not afraid to use it. I'm not for hurling. So, of course, we're joking. But yeah, it is. It's something when what people don't seem to understand is that when people use threatening language about you and your family, you know, so it's my family now, it's you. And when people use that sort of language about you or share our photos online or call me a race traitor or do all that sort of stuff, it doesn't just stay online. Like all kinds of online trolling, it doesn't just stay online. You worry for your family's safety. And that's something you said to me recently. It was so funny. You just, I said, God, I'm so tense all the time. It's like there's always the low level hum of anxiety and tension and worrying that it'll become physical. And you went, welcome. And I went, oh, another moment for the white girl to catch the fuck up. Is there anything I could be doing better? Is there, you know, for any of us who are trying to do better, questions we could ask, is there anywhere we should start?
Oh, that's a big question.
Yeah, but is there anyone we should listen to or...
Well, anyone
read.
Should listen. Well, I mean, right now, who I'm reading mostly is Ta-Nehisi Coates, and I think he's got a pretty good understanding about what's going on, especially in the world, if not with race, and especially in America at the moment, and especially his second book, "We Were 8 Years in Power." It's really kind of opening my head up a bit. I would say it would do the same for many others. Questions to ask. We all have to take a look at ourselves, and our behaviors and how we are connecting with other people, I think. Like, as you said, for instance, you've had this journey. I think
I feel like I'm only starting it.
Well, I think you've come quite a long way. And a lot of that was because you had the courage to, you know, ask yourself some hard questions, as well as, you know, asking me some hard questions. And like I said, I don't mind having the conversation if someone is, you know, open to, you know, actually learning something. But if it's just going to be less defensive, I guess. If someone says something to you along the lines of, I think that might not be okay, what you just said, take it on board and go, oh, okay, well, what should I have said? What should I have done? What is it about what I said that was a problem? Don't just shut down and go, well, you know, you're just a social justice
warrior.
Asshole, yeah. And you should fuck off.
And PC's gone too far. Yeah. The other thing, though, is, and that's a good, this is maybe a good point to wrap up on, but we can't always rely on the people who are taking the brunt of the discrimination to do all the educating for us. We need to educate ourselves as best we can. So read people who are writing about it, follow advocates on social media or whatever. And the other thing is when someone, so maybe you say, hey, what you said there is not okay. Maybe it's on a day that you've lost your patience because someone's just touched your fucking hair and called you Lionel Richie and in a burger place and your wife is being defensive at home. And then this person says something more overtly racist and you just turn around and go, fuck off. And so those tropes about angry people of color is like, that comes from bits of fucking exhaustion. I think people need to realize that too, that in that moment where you didn't mean too much harm, it might be the 50th fucking thing in a row. Is that fair?
That's more than fair. I don't really lose my temper very much.
No, I tiptoe around it at all. I close those doors quietly.
Now, see, people are going to believe that.
No, they're not. They don't believe anything because we're all Egypts. We're all doing our best. I'm the queen of the Egypts. That's the only power I have is in Egyptland. So because we're in Egyptland, we're on Taranoia, which you know better than most what Taranoia is like. No, I see. Now people are going to believe that that's true. I just laughed.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Fuck you. Oh, my God. That special dinner is off. I'm not cooking anything for you for a week.
Oh, it worked.
How dare you? What is your paranoia, do you reckon? What are you paranoid about? What is your greatest fear or insecurity? It doesn't have to be a rational one.
My greatest fear or insecurity? My greatest fear or insecurity is saying something stupid in a public forum, i.e. podcast radio.
Thanks, fellow Egypts. See you soon. Thank you, Carl Austin.
Thank you, Tara Flynn.
Don't call me by my full name.
This has been a production of the Head Stuff Podcast Network.